Welcome back to Arts About.
Show about art that has every intention of being a work of art in itself.
Sometimes good, sometimes not so good. And welcome to another Sunday morning discussion about things that we're interested in with artist in residence and cultural sounding board John Baird, the fabulous poetic Mark Stewart, and me, Sally Bailey. Arts About is brought to you by the generosity of the McClelland Sculpture Park and Gallery and facilitated by the Bendigo Bank Studio. Did you know, everybody, that the McClelland Gallery have just recently appointed a new director?
I didn't know that.
At the opening of their newest exhibition, Framing Nature, the Board of Trustees announced the new director to be curator Lisa Byrne. Do you know anything about her?
Don't know anything about Lisa.
Not yet. No. We'll soon find out. What's the opening?
Perhaps Framing. We'll send Mark Framing. Down there.
That's a good idea. Framing Nature is the exhibition. That would be good, actually.
I'll go and see it.
It's a look at landscapes from varying perspectives, I believe.
Okay, good.
What are you going to be on about this week, John?
Unterwasser. The world famous artist.
Unterwasser, yes. 70s hippie.
Unterwasser.
Otherwise
underwater.
Known as Regentag, which means rainy day in German. And he was an Austrian artist who was big in the 70s. And he was a bit of a hippie. And he came to Melbourne when I was an art student.
Oh, okay. Fabulous.
Leaving me with a disturbing taste in my mouth.
Oh, my God.
Okay, that doesn't sound too good. That doesn't bode well at all. What about you, Mark?
I'm going to talk about the Archibald that we saw in Geelong last week and also Marina Abramovic.
Ah, okay. Oh, yeah. Okay, well, the way he looked at me then means I don't think he likes her.
I do.
Oh, do you?
You're going to squeeze past her.
No, that's all been done, John. She's no. It's more about the show at the Museum of Modern Art in New York called The Artist Is Present.
Where yes, I was there. I went and saw that, actually.
Did you see her? Did you see
Yes,
it?
I did. I didn't sit. The queue was so incredibly long.
750,000 people went to see her.
And it was also timed with a retrospective of her work as well. So the nude couple that you walked through with was there, but it wasn't her, obviously.
No, and they weren't as close as what she and Uli were.
They were pretty close, though. Well, you had to turn sideways.
Well, you had to squeeze and actually touch them when they
you
were...
Had to pretty much, well, okay, yeah, okay. I can imagine that they would have been more provocative.
What if
that
you're
sounds
fat?
Great.
John, please, you're not allowed to say that anymore.
Oh. Okay, so while we were in Geelong, we had a wonderful time because we saw a couple of Von Gerards while we were there, and we also had a wonderful Italian lunch at the fabulous Lipari Cafe. Thanks very much to our next guest, Gabe North, or Dr. Gabe as we like to call her, who directed us along there. As I mentioned, she's on the show in a minute and she's been travelling around the globe with her new husband. And she's returned with some amazing tales of the new Louvre in Abu Dhabi and was actually there at its opening only a few weeks ago. So we're going to be in for a treat with that one. I've also discovered that one of our presenters on RPP, Clint Hamill, who used to do our film reports, has contributed a story to an extraordinary comic book series called Killaroo. It was created by Darren Close. Killaroo's a native anti-hero and urban legend of the Australian outback. And as you can imagine, Killaroo is a giant kangaroo called Rufus. I'm also going to have a quick chat with Bernie Capicciano, and he's the owner of Bernie's Music Land in Ringwood. They've got a visiting world-renowned organist Tony Fenelon in the store on the 13th and the 14th of this month to do a Christmas extravaganza concert. So we're going to find out a little bit about that. So while we get Dr. Gabe settled in her seat and in front of the mic, here's a little bit of Arabic groove to get you in the mood for us to hear all about the United Arab Emirates. This is Cheba Fadela with Nselfik. As I mentioned earlier, it's been quite some time since we had the great pleasure of talking to Dr. Gabe in the studio on Arts About. And since she's been here, she's had a name change and is now Dr. Gabe Northani after her recent marriage to Leo. Congratulations and welcome to Arts About, Gabe North.
I'm such a blessed bride, aren't I, Sally?
Yes, indeed you are. Mm-hmm. Hey, you've been on some pretty amazing adventures recently with your new husband into the mysterious lands of the United Arab Emirates.
Yeah.
Was that on your honeymoon?
No, this was just a little bit of a break to do a little bit of the Middle East and particularly the Arabian Gulf. So through Oman as well as the UAE, which was a fantastic time. The most the centerpiece, if you like, of course, was the opening of the Louvre in Abu Dhabi on the 11th of November.
The centerpiece, indeed, and of course, that's why we've got you in here to talk today. I've seen the pictures. It's an extraordinary building out in the desert, designed by Jean Nouvel. Mm-hmm. How and why did you manage to get a gig there at the opening?
Well, it's just serendipitous, really. It was supposed to be built in 2012, and there's been delay after delay after delay. I suspect some issues with regard to the contract with the Louvre Museums in France also. I think that's been a bit of an issue. Apparently, the Louvre name was a 400 million euro deal. Just for the brand alone.
400 million. That's an expensive logo,
that's before you build
logo,
the thing,
isn't it?
Yeah.
Now, you can get a Da Vinci for that.
Indeed. there's about 93,000 square metres of museum space there on what's called Saadiyat Island, which is going to be the Abu Dhabi's cultural precinct. The Guggenheim's also under construction there at the moment. And for the Arts About listeners that may not necessarily be au fait with how big 93,000 square metres is, if you think of Bayside, my shopping centre down in Frankston, which covers nearly four city blocks, that's 88,000 square metres.
Because, of course, for our listeners that don't know, Dr. Gabe does have an alter ego, and that is as centre manager of Bayside down in Frankston, which is, of course, also where we have our new pop-up studio down there.
Indeed it is.
You've been on it recently, haven't you,
Kate? I was on last Friday talking about Sensitive Santa and our plans for Christmas, which was terrific. So back to the...
Back to art.
Yeah, anyway, that's my side gig. back to Abu Dhabi. There's actually 23 permanent galleries, as well as a children's gallery, massive media centre, retail, restaurants in this whole precinct, which is under an enormous umbrella of this beautiful roof that I think you've probably heard a little bit about.
I've seen pictures of it, and I believe it's like layer upon layer upon layer of crisscrossing stainless steel structures and aluminium structures that creates
exactly
a constellation, essentially, doesn't it?
It is. And spookily enough, because of zero rainfall in Abu Dhabi...
Zero.
Yeah, zero. There, it is only a overlay of aluminium, which... Apparently, the intent of the design was to look like a Bedouin traditional encampment where they use palm fronds for a roof and they lay them crisscross over one another.
A little like our rum shelter up in far north Queensland.
Of course. So the structure itself is called Rain of Light, and you get these shafts of light that penetrate through to the gallery space, which is incredible. It just makes the whole experience just so much richer.
So there's 23 buildings standing underneath this extraordinary roof.
Yep. Little white, they look like mud brick type constructions of varying sizes and shapes. And you sort of enter, it's a very much a chronological journey through the gallery, starting with Mesopotamia and then working its way through. The Egyptian collection, which considering a lot of that has come from France, you can appreciate how incredible that is. And I think the thing that surprised me, Sally, more than anything was I assumed that it would be secondary or tertiary pieces. But what you're seeing on display are hero items, objects of all kinds, from Egyptian mummies and canopic jars and sarcophagi through to tapestries from the Museum of the Medieval Museum, the Cluny in Paris. You've got the tapestries hanging through to Magritte and Mondrian and Whistler, and you even have a Leonardo that you can stand in front of, and there's no bulletproof glass.
Which Leonardo?
It's a female portrait. Okay. I can't remember
not
the name
the
of it.
Is it the
No, it's not. But you can stand in front of it and there's no bulletproof glass. There's no Asians taking selfies. It is just all yours to stand in front of. It's an incredibly intimate experience.
For the time being.
This is all kind of strange information to me, but do you think that the thing with the Louvre, calling it the Louvre and paying all that money to do so, is that just a branding exercise or do they have a relationship with the Louvre Gallery in France?
No, I think that there is most certainly a cross-pollination now of an alliance that has been formed as a consequence of this deal, but I believe I don't know personally, John, but I would believe that this is definitely very consistent with the Arabic appetite for luxury brands.
Yeah.
And you only have to
look... given that they're going for the Guggenheim as well.
Well, yeah. That was what I was about to say, is that the Guggenheim started all this off with the Bilbao Guggenheim,
yep,
where they realised that it totally changed the whole structure of the city, that it was an old port which was falling into disrepair, and they built the Guggenheim and suddenly the whole city's... You know,
well, the whole living. World's visiting
well,
Bilbao
exactly.
now.
And yeah, that's right. Is it Frank... not Frank Gehry. Wright, what's his name? Yeah, Gehry building the Guggenheim in also?
No, I don't know. No, I haven't.
I think it is.
We're going to have to go there, Sally. I think we'll just whack that on a list.
Okay.
Future itinerary.
Okay.
The other thing about the Louvre is, as I've said before, that there's only 5% of the collection shown in the galleries, so that you know the 95% is sitting in the cellar, in the caves. So they, you know, the idea of bringing it out and giving it to other people or selling
it's a Monty, really, isn't it?
If well, it is a wonderful an idea, and there is this wonderful communication between France and the Arabic countries, which has been, you know, for a long time. They have a lot of respect for them. So it's for us it seems a bit strange, but I think for the French it seems just perfectly normal.
I mean, given that the kind of collections that we're used to seeing and the kind of artwork that we're used to seeing in all of these French museums and galleries, how does that sit, do you think, with Arabic sensibilities? Because that it's very, very conflicting.
It's a really interesting thing that's going on there thematically with this gallery, because they are very much trying to make this the nexus between all forms of art, and they take their inspiration from the roof and the whole idea of light. The strap line for the gallery is "See humanity in a new light," and so you're seeing in these very conservative countries for the first time busts, you're seeing nudity, which is something that is very foreign to them.
You're also seeing the human body depicted.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And they've made a point in all the banners that as you enter Abu Dhabi, down their main promenade, all the Louvre banners say, "We are all born under the same light." And there is definitely a gesture of peace and harmony that is attempting to be expressed through this.
Go art.
Yeah, go art, exactly. Do you think it'll have an effect on the Arab
tourism?
Culture really is what I was thinking.
Yeah, yeah. Look, I think when you're in there, I think we have, through our Western media, a very myopic view.
Absolutely.
Of the Arabic sentiment and mentality. And I think when you're in there, you can see that there are very... peace-loving people, families, just
and
going...
cultivated and sophisticated.
Correct,
yeah. Yeah.
Correct.
Just for example, Arabic women are the biggest buyers of lingerie in the world. So, you know, what's underneath is really very interesting for
yes,
what we
absolutely.
See.
Yes, absolutely.
But, sorry, I see that they've paid 600 million euros just to have for the name and $747 million for art exchange loans and management advice. So you know, they are spending quite a lot of money, but it's a wonderful thing. I think it's good for everybody.
It is, and it's the great thing about the culture, from what I see, is there's forward planning. They plan for the next generation and the generation after that, which is very much not how our governments work here, obviously.
No.
So it's a 30-year contract with the Louvre, with an ever-decreasing content from the French museums as they bolster their own collections up. It's a very significant collection, but that's the agreement. It's a 30-year deal, which you would assume by that time they will have sufficiently established themselves as a locus of art to come to the Middle East. So
do you
it's
know
a clever
they
contract.
They have a piece from Melbourne from the NGV. They have the piece which was stolen from India. Is it the Buddha? I think there was a Buddha.
Oh, I didn't see it. I did see some indigenous art, which usually had a lot of interest. My favourite pieces, though, which I thought were brilliantly conceived, was they had a whole Art Deco cabinet. And by that, I don't mean a cupboard. I mean a room that they had taken out of New York from the 1920s. So I'm thinking it's a building like the Frick or that sort of era. And they've reinstalled it there with all of the parquetry and the marquetry and the joinery of this room, and they've recreated it so you can actually step into a 1920s room. It was, oh, it's just
incredible.
Stunning. Yeah.
So what are your impressions of Arab life, having immersed yourself in it? I mean, my experiences of it so far are only that I've read Thesiger's Arabian Sands and I've been to the Abu Dhabi and the Dubai airport. So they're quite conflicting views of the Emirates. What is it like really?
I find there's some crazy bits that I don't get. For example, Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan, who is the Crown Prince of Abu Dhabi, hasn't been seen in 7 or 8 years. Not a sighting. And all the local discourse is that he's been cryovacked or something.
Or he's deformed or something.
Because they don't have a system of a natural hereditary monarchy, say, that we have in Great Britain, where we already know who's going to be the successor to the throne. This sheikh has literally 15, 20 children from which he can choose his successor, which is apparently in a box. The name is already in a box in case something happens to him. Otherwise, it's not announced till he dies. So the whole, it's all very nebulous how that whole structure works. So that's interesting. But the beautiful palace and, I mean, the wealth is, it's just incredible. And the arbitrary decisions around what's going to be built and what isn't, is there's no feasibility studies or anything. They just simply go for it. There's no bureaucracy because it's a principality. So they do what the hell they like, really.
Amazing, amazing. Very exciting that you actually managed, and incredible that you managed to get there to the opening.
Yeah.
Now, we've been missing your wonderful series, The Profound Thread, that you do with your sidekick and my husband, Will Bailey.
Mm.
Are we likely to ever hear from you two again?
Well, I think we'd have to retrieve Will from a similarly cryovac state. And if we can perhaps encourage him out of, if we can thaw him out, there's a possibility, perhaps.
It's really wonderful having you in here. Thank you so much for visiting us.
Lovely.
And if you have any pictures that you'd be happy for us to put up on the website of your visit there, perhaps you, because of course you met the director of the gallery,
didn't you? Yes, he welcomed me. Leo and I were probably the 15th or... Yeah, it would have been less than 15, maybe 12 or 15 through the actual gallery. So
did
we
you
got
push
to walk,
everybody out of the way?
We literally walked into rooms where the cleaners were walking out on the other side just trying to give the last builders clean to the place.
So were you just going past when they were opening and you decided to go in?
No, we booked the tickets about 4 months ago.
Right.
All sorts of dramas with that. But the opening day sold out a couple of months before, so we're really privileged to be there.
Who is the director?
His name is Manuel Rabate. He's a French gentleman. And is he a spokesperson for that place? His first gesture at the entry was to have his photo taken with two children that were in the queue, ready to go in, two Indian children with their parents, and gave them some gifts and said, "This is exactly who I want at the front of the queue."
Nonetheless, he would build the concept of France being the high point of Western art, given that they've taken on the name of the Louvre and they've got a French director and there's no doubt lots of French paintings in the
Indeed, but great capacity is being built amongst the UAE cohort in the gallery. So while at the moment it is very, very much French dominated in terms of the internal human resources, that's definitely going to change because they have a whole education piece.
The Arab Emirates would have a great relationship with American Expressionism, wouldn't they, because of their liking for non-figurative art?
There was an absolute buttload of that stuff there.
Was there? Right,
yeah. Nice way
That's
to
actually
put it.
An Arabic term, of
Is
course.
It?
Yeah, buttload. Well worth a visit.
Well, perhaps we better open up that subject again another time. Thank you so much.
Sorry, there were 4,650 museum experts and archaeologists in France who signed a petition against the deal, by the way.
Wow, goodness me.
But I think it was a wonderful idea. Good kudos to the French for that.
Indeed.
Thanks again, Dr. Gabe. It's wonderful to have you on. The piano, keyboard and organ superstore Bernie's Music Land is the largest piano and organ specialty store in Australia and is still overseen by its founder, Bernie Capicchiano, after almost 40 years. Since opening its own store in Airport West in October 1977, Bernie's Music Land grew to 11 stores with 5 music schools spread across the Mornington and Victoria country towns and has since consolidated into the superstore in Ringwood in 1990. Its community involvement is extensive and Bernie's Music Land sponsors a large range of musical groups and community activities, assists schools and music groups, and offers sponsorship to pianists and organists. And their Live at Bernie CD label provides artists with a platform to gain recognition and industry exposure. They're a generous supporter of RPPFM and have provided us with our magnificent grand piano that we have in the recording studio. This festive season, they're presenting a Christmas celebration concert with Tony Fenelon, who's a world-renowned organist, and on Wednesday the 13th. So to tell us a little bit about the founder of the store and most cherished sponsor of RPP, Bernie Capicchiano himself. Good morning, Bernie. Welcome to Arts About.
Good morning, Sally. It's wonderful to be able to talk to you.
Thank you so much for taking the time. Bernie, you've had a long-running relationship with the keyboard. Has it been a dream come true to build a life encouraging and enabling young lovers of the keyboard?
Oh, it certainly has been a dream. It's quite an amazing part of life to share music and to see how many can enjoy music themselves. It's been a great time.
You must have assisted many young aspiring musicians that have gone on to become professional artists over such a span of time. Have you? Are there any you could mention to us today?
Well, there's many.
They're everywhere.
Quite an extensive area. We were originally with instrumental people as well. We love supporting the vocal scene because the vocal scene, of course, they need good pianos to accompany vocals in the Estedfords, the competitions.
Oh, yes.
There's many. Then with our recording through the team of pianists on the piano with young pianists, obtained international acclaim through that.
Well, I know we've had many of them.
It's wonderful fun, yes.
We've had many of them playing on RPP at various times, I know. Your huge main store in Ringwood, it has an auditorium in it.
We call it our workshop area, Sally. It's not directly an auditorium, but it's quite a comfortable space, and people enjoy being able to be up close with artists and be able to see what's going on in here. It's only small as far as numbers are concerned, but if any of the listeners haven't been here, certainly I hope they can come on the 13th of December. That's when we, as you've mentioned, we've got Tony Fenelon. Tony's been a great mate for, well, nearly the 40 years that we've been going. We have actually clocked up our 40 years in October, so we're now in our 41st year.
Oh, my goodness. Yes, okay.
Exciting times. But if some of the listeners were available to come, actually in December 2013, we recorded one of Tony's workshops, and the CD is absolutely sensational. So if any of the listeners would like to mention when they book, they can book online, which is musicland.com.au. They can book online. If they mention their RPP listeners, I'll make sure that they get an autographed copy of the workshop CD from December 13, which is absolutely unbelievable to listen to.
Tony's an Australian man then?
Oh, yes. Melbourne man, and has been acclaimed internationally, though for 10 years he had an international contract with the Roland Corporation, playing mainly in England and America. He played at 10 of the American, what they call organ power programs in Los Angeles, and is absolutely, he's one of these natural musicians that not only does he play well, but he's great to be and listen to.
Fabulous. Well, it's not often that you get to hear organ music played anymore. So I imagine that if that is something that you like, here's a great chance next week at Bernie's Musicland. Thank you so very much for joining us on Arts About this morning, Bernie.
You're very welcome, Sally. Can I mention it's more than organ music? It's actually orchestral organ. String symphonies and things. It's just a magic sound. And look forward to seeing some of the listeners to come along.
I'll put a link on our Facebook page so our listeners can find the show. So many thanks to you, Bernie Capicchiano. Here's a taste of what you might hear. I've actually found a track of Tony Fenelon playing himself, and I'm going to play it after we've spoken. Thank you so much again, Bernie.
Oh, that's great news. Yeah. Thank you too.
Bye.
Hope everyone has a great day.
Our next guest, Darren Close, has a passion for the comic genre and has been involved as a writer, an artist and editor for many years. Best known for running his website, Oz Comics, he's created a character that will perhaps transcend all others. Killaroo is the first major release for Darren, and Killaroo is, as the name suggests, a dangerous kangaroo, a native anti-hero and urban legend of the Aussie outback. Killaroo's a loner, wandering across the Australian landscape on his motorbike, only too happy to enter into a brawl. He's a tough-looking kangaroo called Rufus, prone to violent mood swings, with an ironically soft spot for protecting the environment. He's prompted a series that really interested me, and I was alerted to it by one of our presenters on RPP, and previously on Arts About, our film reviewer, Clint Hamill, who has written one of the stories in the new book. It's a genre I know little about, and yet it is a wonderful, innovative work that deserves a wider viewing, and I wanted to hear more about it myself. So I followed up on it, and to tell us more, creator, editor, writer, and comic luminary Darren Close joins us this morning on Arts About. Good morning, Darren.
Morning.
Thank you so much for talking to us today.
No worries.
Darren, comic books are such a complex combination of storytelling, artistry, collaboration of many artists, and often with storylines that are set in subcultures or apocalyptic alternative universes. What got you into comic books? Or is that a stupid question that I've already answered?
I think as a kid in school, I was always into drawing and sketching, and I met a friend of mine there who was making his own comic books. So I guess as well as trading comics and so forth and reading them with him, I started to find a focus for my artwork. So I followed his footsteps in starting to draw my own comics.
We often think about comic books as sort of being representing a real subculture. Is that really true of them, or like, why do you get into comic books in the first place? Is it really something that grows out of a kid's love of these things?
I think so. I think some people like just enjoying the stories and the escapism that sort of goes with them. But I think if you like drawing and you can sort of get drawn into these worlds of other characters and so forth, I don't know, it sort of made me want to do my own and tell my own stories.
Mm. Comic books look a lot like filmmakers' storyboards. Are you all...
Very much so.
Yeah. Are you a frustrated filmmaker?
I guess I do. As I'm visualising a story, I tend to storyboard it in my head and then I put it onto the page. So I guess there's a certainly like the storyteller aspect of a filmmaker, I guess, is there. And it's just, I think a lot of filmmakers actually often get their scripts and ideas professionally done as storyboards because it makes for a much easier pitch to studios. So I think there's a natural...
I think there is too.
There.
Tell us about Killaroo. How did Killaroo come to life?
Well, I was at university and there was a university magazine called The Third Degree, which had a comic strip running in it, and I didn't really like it, and I started getting a bit cocky and thought, I can do better than this. But what will I write about? And I just came up with this idea of, I think there was something in the news about kangaroo hunting or something like that, or like a kangaroo that got an arrow, was found with an arrow stuck through its neck or something like that. That was revealed to be like kids having a prank or something like that. And I just had the idea of what about if the kangaroo could fight back? And it was just a silly little one-page gag story about a kangaroo that took out some uni students. And that's all it was for several years. It was just like a single one-page story. But when I started Oz Comics and meeting a bunch of other creators and artists and so forth, I started thinking, well, and seeing sort of all the fun they were having in making comics and remembering the fun I had when I was growing up making comics, I thought, well, maybe I can dust off this character and develop it a little bit better and see what happens. And that was about 12 issues ago.
Wow. So I've read somewhere that the opening premise of the Killaroo Gang Wars series comes from a true roadhouse shootout that happened in New South Wales in the 80s. Is that true?
No, I don't.
Oh. it's a fantasy that I've read somewhere about
well,
Rufus,
perhaps. I've got a little elevator pitch I've just been putting together.
Tell us. Yes, because I was just going to ask you, can you give us a synopsis? That would be great.
Yeah, Killaroo is the story of a military experiment in the 1970s to create the ultimate soldier for Australian conditions. They developed a hybrid creature between a man and a kangaroo with enhanced abilities and military training. After spending time with an Aboriginal community, who actually believe him to be a spirit from the dream time. He now roams the outback and tries to find his place in it, belonging neither to the animal kingdom nor the world of man.
Woohoo.
That's basically the elevator pitch.
Well, it sounds fantastic. I've had a brief look at it, and I'm expecting to pick mine up from the post office today. I've ordered myself a couple. I know they'll make remarkable gifts. Tell me, Darren, do you think we have an Australian style of comic, or are you actually inventing one?
Sorry, in regards to an Australian style, did you say?
Yeah.
I think Australian comics, there's a very broad range of styles. Killaroo is probably more along the lines of like the US publishers, like Marvel, DC. It's kind of more superhero than a lot of Australian comics, because a lot of them are sort of independent style. It's hard to really pigeonhole Australian comics into one particular style, because there's autobiographical comics, as I said, there's a few superhero titles, but a lot of it's just slice of life. It's just a bunch of people that like to tell stories, whether that's from their real life or their imagined one.
Well, it's a fascinating genre. I hadn't actually seen it before. It was, as I mentioned earlier, Clint, who used to be our film reviewer, alerted me to it and sent me an image, and I just thought, this is amazing stuff. I'm going to put a link on our Facebook page so our listeners can get to have a look at it. Gang Wars is on sale now. What number in Gang Wars is this one? What episode?
I'm just about to release issue 4 of Gang Wars. That'll be out in a couple of weeks' time.
Sensational. But the others are available now. As I said, I'll put a link to the Facebook page so our listeners can get a look at it. Thank you so much for talking to us about it today, and good luck with Killaroo, Darren Close.
No problem. Thanks very much.
See you later.
And now it's time for John On.
Thank you, Sally. And thank you, Swanee. Mark, when I was an art student at RMIT, there was quite a lot of enthusiasm suddenly around the joint for an artist called Unterwasser, an Austrian artist called Unterwasser. Yes.
Unterwasser?
Yep. And suddenly there were, you know, when I was there at RMIT, we all had little pigeonholes in the art building with our names on them, and they all suddenly filled up with these little black books that were full of Unterwasser prints. They're all different, oddly, you know. Well, I don't know how many variations there were, but I didn't come across another one that was the same as the one that I had. Suddenly bookshops were full of calendars. The NGV had little posters up. It was this massive flood of information that just hit Melbourne.
I remember it. Yeah.
And then we were told Mr. Unterwasser was coming to RMIT to give us a lecture. Anyone who was interested could go along, and he was going to give us a talk. And I went along to listen to this fella, and he was this was the 1970s, and he was sideboards, caftan, homemade vest, headband, bangles and necklaces, that kind of thing, very much the hippie. And he started giving us a talk about the importance of sincerity and love in art, and the absolute necessity of getting colour appropriate and right, and avoiding straight lines, all that sort of guff. But he also started talking about how the pigment in paints was a very important thing, and that the best pigments were available, and he started mentioning brands of paint. And I remember thinking, this is like a sales thing, you know. Oh, he's selling paint. And he went on about that a little bit, but not over the top. And eventually he said that he was very interested in Australia and in New Zealand, in fact that he was moving to New Zealand, but he was thrilled to be in Australia, and he's on his way down to Wilson's Promontory on that weekend. And if there was anyone there who'd like to go and see him down there, he'd be more than happy to talk to anyone who came down, and he'd be down there drawing and staying in a little tent. So that weekend, about five of us jumped in a car and took off down to the prom to go and see Mr. Underwasser. And on the way down there, we stopped, as we normally did when we're going down that way, at the Fish Creek Hotel. And guess who's in the public bar of the Fish Creek Hotel? Drunk, but Mr. Underwasser.
Drunk?
He was drunk. And he had with him a bleary-eyed and maybe chemically bewildered young woman who I recognised from the art school. And I thought, what's going on here? Has he abducted her or something? And anyway, we went in there and there was a bit of conversation with him, and I was talking to her, and she had no idea where she was or what was going on. She was
Australian.
Well, yeah, and she was from RMIT. Okay. He'd picked her up at the art school, presumably. And a couple of us had a chat with her, and it became clear that she not only did she not know where she was, she didn't really want to be there. And so we whisked her off and out to the car and suggested to her that we could sort of get her away from there. And then the rest of us got into the car and ready to leave. And the last time I saw the world-famous artist Mr. Underwasser, he was standing at the side door of the bar of the Fish Creek Hotel swearing at us in Austrian and quite angry. Perhaps he had a right to be, I don't know.
Well, the poor girl's gone from one man to five men, so it's...
No, we weren't all men.
Oh, I see, okay.
Yeah. And we wanted to go to his promontory, but realised that he'd probably think that's where we were going, and we didn't want to be chased around by a world-famous artist, so we went to Venice Bay instead. Mm.
Did you ever hear about him?
Afterwards? Only briefly here and there. He did, in fact, move to New Zealand, and he became a very well-known sort of countercultural architect around New Zealand and around the rest of the world as well. Was very interested in wobbly buildings with bright colours on them, that sort of thing, trees growing inside.
Yeah, he was quite famous. He was like a Bauhaus figure. So it wasn't just about painting. It was about everything. It was about architecture, ceramics.
He had a holistic view.
Yes, and it was all about colour. You probably see it's very sort of flat colour, a little bit like Gustav Klimt, with more colour and very flat. Very popular in the 70s and early 80s and completely forgotten about now, as often happens to those who are shining during their own time, but doesn't continue.
Yeah.
Now, we had a pretty good trip this week, didn't we?
Over to the Geelong Gallery, Underwasser over there.
No Underwasser, no.
In fact, we're on top of the water.
Yeah, we did. We went over on the ferry. It was a road trip. It was quite good fun, wasn't it?
It was good.
And we had a look at the Archibald Prize.
Yes, which wasn't disappointing.
No.
We were already expecting not so much. I don't know, did you come back with it with any sort of startling images in your brain? Did it?
Well, I must admit that John Olsen one really stayed in my head.
Oh, really? We should see that Rachel Griffiths SBS series of Archibald. Because you see the guy whose name, Nicholas Harding, painting John Olsen and talking about the painting. It's quite interesting. You see the whole process. So it all looks
very familiar to me. The Archibald is a brand, and within the brand is pretty much what you expect every time I see that.
Isn't this the sort of the whole basis of any prize is that there's not going to, it's very rare that you find something startling. It makes me think of Dobell when you're in 48, and I'm thinking about who were the judges, who's judging then, who had the courage to actually give him that prize, or perhaps he didn't have so many competitors, I don't know, as opposed to
he was a very well-known painter when he won that prize, and he was also a very big supporter of the gallery.
Okay.
And a very conservative sort of man, actually. And
I think Dobell, the
board,
was he?
Yeah, and I think the board might have been a very conservative board as well.
Okay.
Well the paintings are not conservative.
No, the paintings
that one
amazing.
Wasn't.
Yeah.
No. Anyway, the guy who won, what's his name? Michael something?
I don't know.
It's really, it was okay, the painting, but it's nothing special.
Well, I must admit that I was rather surprised standing in front of it, that I was the
nuances that you can't see in the photo.
Yes, absolutely, yes.
Yeah, Mitch Cairns is his name.
Mitch Cairns, that's right, and the eyes and the mouth, and just that the detail of the face was much more powerful than I had given it credit for beforehand.
Mm.
Not necessarily again, I wouldn't say it would have been my choice.
No.
Of them.
Anyway, I think the what we saw was all sort of relatively conservative. But there's, I'd just like to read Sophie Hewson, who was in there, and what she writes about her painting, which was like a Disney thing about Richard Bell. I don't know. Do you know Richard Bell?
Yep.
So she starts. I'm reading from what her quote here. What does white guilt look like? Is there a hierarchy of oppressions? Do we live in a nation of roughly equal opportunity, or do we live in a fantasy land, a cracked cartoon landscape brimming with fairy tale myths of freedom and democracy, asks Sophie Hewson. The Archibald Prize was named after the founding editor of a magazine, The Bulletin, known for his racist editorial declarations. Is that true?
Mm.
Mm. What, racist against who?
Just about everyone except him.
Okay. From 1999 until 2005, the prize was sponsored by the Colonial Foundation Trust. And in 96 years, we have never awarded the prize to a person of colour.
That's not true.
Okay. Who, when?
I can think of a couple of Indigenous artists who've won the Archibald Prize.
Okay. Whose name you can't remember?
No.
No, okay. It's a situation for which this work is no remedy, talking about her own work.
That's, that painting that you're talking about, that she painted,
remember, yeah.
I really thought was probably my least favourite of the entire lot. It was. Well, I'm struggling not to say awful.
Yes. Well, look, it's interesting, and what she says is so it just seems very much a millennial. She's born in 1984. The problem of sort of trying to back up the weakness of your painting by what you're trying to say
about it. Yes.
And it seems when you read about what a lot of people are saying, it is it's still about it. You have to sort of put it into a story, which is for me again. If it's about a story, then you might as well write it. Why are you painting it?
I think that's a real problem about marketing actually these days, and that they have you're sitting there with this book in front of you, which you bought while we were there at the gallery, and they're the onus of a gallery to produce something like that that then of course must have words in it, and so that kind of it grows into this thing that has to become about words when in fact it's a thing about images.
Mm. The Geelong Gallery, which I rather like, actually. Yes, I think it's a beautiful thing.
It was a lovely
thing. It's a great big heavy building as you go in, very sort of late Victorian, with wooden floors and all of the things that you expect to go with a building like that, and rather delightfully lightens off as you go out the back door into a 1960s sort of glazed pavilion with a light staircase and that really nice little sculpture room downstairs, which we also enjoyed.
Mm. Yes.
I tell you what I enjoyed. I enjoyed talking with the deputy director, Penny Whitehead, who we had a chat with beforehand, which was, and heard her explanation in a way of how important, why the Archibald is important for regional galleries or galleries that actually get the go-ahead to present the Archibald, because it has such an ongoing economic flow through both to the gallery itself, because I think the numbers of visitors is increased. I mean, I think they've got more visitors at the Archibald this year than they get in the gallery in the entire year.
Well, that's virtually the same with every gallery. Right?
Yes. Yeah. And
they get the door.
And they get yes, they do. They get a certain amount of money from the door. But they also, but the community also gets a lot too. She was talking about how the shop holders and the cafes and all of those sort of things, all of those businesses around the gallery actually get a cut as well.
Absolutely.
Because, it's very
there's an Italian restaurant in Geelong that got our business as a result.
Absolutely. Cafe Lingari. What was it called?
Lipari.
It was wonderful.
This is a continuation of the Bilbao effect, the Guggenheim in Bilbao in Spain, and also what they're doing in the Abu Dhabi. The people have realised it's through culture that they're going to get, they're getting business.
And Hobart.
Mostly because there's just so much more leisure. People have the money and they're not going to be working as much, so they're looking for things to do. They get sick to death of sport and so they go to culture.
Yeah. Or they do both.
Okay. Here we go.
Ah.
Hark.
Indeed.
Time for the news. Sorry to cut you off, Mark. There's so much
quite all right.
To say,
I just wanted to say there's one show you need to see, Romancing the Skull at the Ballarat Art Gallery to January the 28th.
What is it called?
Romancing the Skull.
Oh, okay. Mm.
Skulls.
Gosh, goodness me. Well, as I mentioned earlier, there's big news at McClelland. There's a new director announced, curator Lisa Byrne, and we hope we might strike up a
relationship. Do we know anything about Lisa?
No, we don't really yet. So let's hope we can get her on the show and get to know her a little bit better.
That sounds like a good idea. Bernie's Music Land Organ Christmas Concert with Tony Fenelon on Wednesday the 13th of December. Tickets on their website.
Killaroo Gang Wars, get yourself a copy. It would make a great Christmas present. I'll put a link on your Facebook page, or go to the Facebook page to buy them.
Yeah. Now, the inaugural NGV Triennial is on four levels of the NGV International, featuring over 100 artists and designers from 32 countries presenting a global snapshot of contemporary art and design. They've also got some interviews and conversations with some of the artists there, including former Fantasma, Richard Moss and Ben Quilty. Yeah.
When does that open?
December 15th.
Are we going, Mark?
Well, we haven't been invited yet, but maybe...
Oh, I'll fix that up.
Yep.
This festive season, Stockroom Gallery in Kyneton continues its tradition of bringing you a particularly dark series of exhibitions with... Constellations by Lindsay Gosper, Ups and Downs, the Ryan Sisters, Once Upon a Time, The World Wasn't Brown by Jessica Ledwich.
Ledwich, yes.
Ledwich, as well as a wonderful series of Bushrangers by Kim Barter. We missed talking to about her exhibition called The Kimberley on the Metropole Gallery in Geelong.
Yeah, now the Archball closes today, I'm afraid. If you didn't get to see it, you missed it, unless you're going this afternoon, of course.
McCulloch and McCulloch had their seasonal art parade on yesterday, but their associated exhibition runs until the 17th.
Whistlewood.
There's a link on at our Facebook page.
Yeah. Now, if you've just tuned in, you've missed Arts About, we'd love to hear from you. So visit our Facebook page and give us a like, and you can find out some of the things that we're going to be talking about on the next show, and also to maybe see a few things that we've been talking about on this one. You can find a link to our Facebook page on the RPP website. So join us again 11 a.m. next Sunday, or hear the repeat on Wednesdays at 12, or listen to the podcasts on the station website. And remember, everybody, we may not know everything about art.
We know what we like. Apologies, Sally, generally.
Oh, it's just me on the knobs at the moment, everybody. I'm not too good at it. See you next week.